Start with Senate Bill 522. Senator Starr,
please.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 522A comes from Senator Starr, allows the court to terminate parental rights if the court finds that the child was conceived as a result of an act that led to the parent's conviction of rape or other than rape. Three, prohibits the court from awarding custody of a child to the parent convicted of rape if the rape resulted in conception of the child. Mr. Chair, members of the co-chairs, members of the committee, you have the A4 amendments in front of you. These are a result of an email and conversation I had with Mike Livingston, who works for the courts system, and before that, for 20 years, worked in the appellate division for the Department of DOJ. And he pointed out that it would technically help if we tied this particular provision into ORS 419B500. That's the dependency code as it relates to termination of parental rights.
I want to make sure we understand we're in a hearing only.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am State Senator Bruce Starr with the privilege of representing Western Washington County in the Oregon State Senate. Privileged to bring to you this afternoon Senate Bill 522. Like many of you, I'm sure you have constituents that contact you with issues and experiences that they have that they believe need to be fixed. And that is what happened to me as it relates to this particular bill. I had a constituent contact me with a heart-wrenching situation, personal experience. Imagine being a female and being raped and having a child conceived as a result of that horrendous act. Imagine the perpetrator of that act being sentenced and convicted and sent off to take care of the court adjudicated jail time. And as a mother of a child, a victim of a crime, imagine 7 years later that somebody knocks at your door and demands to have access to your child. That was the situation of a constituent of mine. The father of the child that was conceived as a result of a very violent and traumatic event basically came and said, "Hey, I want to be part of this child's life." Needless to say, the mother of the child and the victim of the crime was not real excited about welcoming this person into their life. And strange as it is, in my opinion, that something like this has never been legislated, we soon found out that it had not been. The court had very little that they could do, basically, to say, "Sorry, Mr. Criminal and perpetrator of a horrendous crime, we don't have the ability to send you packing." And that's what brings us to the point we are today. This bill would make that clear, that in the event of a horrendous crime, and you have a conception as a result of that horrendous crime, that the criminal, based on his criminal act, gives up his right to be a parent of that child. I think that it's the appropriate thing for us to do as policymakers, as a father of a daughter, as a husband of a wife. I couldn't imagine having someone that I love have to go through something so traumatic. I appreciate the work that was done in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The bill was amended to make it very clear that we're talking about a first-degree, second-degree rape, not the situation where you have a kind of a boyfriend-girlfriend that happened to be outside the age limits. It also made it very clear that that child support very likely could be awarded in the event of this circumstance. The amendment that's been presented, again, I believe is a technical one. I would leave it in your hands to decide as a House committee whether that's something that you believe is necessary to be included in the bill. As far as I can read it, it seems to make sense to me. To a large extent, I will trust the lawyers, both in the legislature and legislative council, and those that help to serve this committee and the Senate committee as well. But I believe it's time that we fix this particular issue in the statutes. The bill passed, I believe, unanimously on the Senate floor. I again appreciate the fact that this committee is taking it up. I commend it to you and ask that you work the bill and send it on so that we can take care of this particular issue in Oregon State statute. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, it seems strange that that isn't already the law. I think there's a lot of assumptions. Probably if you would have asked people, they would have said, yeah, obviously. Committee members, do you have any questions, comments? The Senator?
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Senate Bill 522 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 45A.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 45A comes to you at the request of Attorney General John Kroger. The Department of Justice standardizes at 30 days request for hearings and child proceedings, removes the presumption of inability to pay child support for those receiving foster care payments, allows service of notice of a child support proceeding by mail service with delivery confirmation as well as certified mail return receipt requested.
Jean Fogarty, please.
Good afternoon. Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, and members of the committee, I'm Jean Fogarty. I'm the Director of the Oregon Child Support Program in the Department of Justice. What you have before you is an efficiencies and housekeeping bill, Senate Bill 45A. There's three major reasons that this bill will improve processes for the child support program and avoid costs. I'll just highlight those three for you. It simplifies processes for child support legal actions by making hearing times consistent. The child support program conducts a variety of administrative legal proceedings to establish paternity, establish support, modify support, establish arrearages, and a variety of other proceedings, all with differing times frames right now. So this is complicated already for our families, but to have hearing times that vary from 14 days to 60 days makes those processes even harder to understand for the staff and for our families that we serve. Secondly, the bill would allow us an alternative of service to certified mail by allowing documents to be served by mail with delivery confirmation. This is a measure where we can avoid costs that are associated with certified mail. Certified mail also is not something that a lot of people like to sign for. So this would be a more effective way of serving process as well. And the third provision I'd like to highlight in the bill is that it would avoid the significant costs of private process servers by allowing DOJ in-house investigators to serve child support documents outside of branch offices. Our child support case managers have the authority to serve process currently at branch offices. This would expand that to outside the office with a significant savings to the program. Right now I have a contract with process servers that are paid by attempt rather than actually effectuating service, and that's a very costly way of doing business. I provided you my written testimony. I can go into some more of the details or answer some questions if you'd like. I just want to point out there's no fiscal to this. There's no known opposition to this bill. Legal aid supports the bill and would be here today except for a conflict. We have the hearings panel support on the bill, and the District Attorney's Association is also in support and testified in the Senate. Elizabeth Cush was in the room if you'd like to hear from her. I thank you for your attention and take any questions that you might have.
Could you just clarify a little bit about the foster care payments?
Certainly, Co-Chair.
What it was and what we're fixing?
Yes. This was a drafting error, Co-Chair, that we've realized soon after the last session. Right now, there are certain presumptions that people that receive certain types of benefits are presumed to be unable to pay a reasonable amount of support. So if you're receiving TANF benefits, if you're receiving certain other benefits, there is an assumption that you're unable to pay. Well, foster care payments, as a foster care parent, was lumped in here. And, of course, being providing foster care, being a parent who receives the stipend to care for our children that are wards of the court, has nothing to do with ability to pay support for your own dependents. So that was just it got scooped in unintentionally to that that presumption of an inability to pay support.
Thank you. Representative Tomei, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So tell me a little bit about this service by mail with delivery confirmation. So I understand one of the problems with certified mail is that if people are working, et cetera, when the mail, certified mail is delivered, there's no one there to sign for it. So tell me the solution here, that how does the party confirm the address?
Well, Co-Chair Krieger and Barker and Representative Tomei, this currently we have we spend a considerable amount of money on certified mail delivery, and as you've said, lots of people are at work, they're not there to sign, and honestly, people don't like to sign certified mail from the state when they don't know what they're signing for. It's just human nature, I guess. So it just hasn't been very effective. Last session, we had a temporary modification of child support bill that was passed in response to the recession. And we put in place using delivery confirmation as a way of documenting that service had been performed as a step up from regular mail, not as stringent as certified mail. We only use this alternative, and it is just an alternative. It doesn't require us to just go to mail confirmation for service. We always would confirm the address that this is where the person was before the process was sent out. So that would be whatever pleadings or motion would be sent out. The delivery confirmation then gives us the date and the time that it was delivered to that address. So we have that that ability to confirm that it was delivered by mail. And as I said, it would be restricted to those situations where we could confirm that the person that was the subject of the proceeding was at that address.
Follow up. Just help me understand that. So then the mail deliverer would confirm, I delivered this mail on this date at this address to this person. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Krieger and Representative Tomei, yes, that's right. It's a service that the Postal Service provides now that we didn't have when this law was put into place.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions? Barker, do you have any? Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you for your attention.
Public hearings until you and I can sit down and talk. Okay. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 45A. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 75.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 75 comes to you from the Department of Corrections, makes permanent the provision that allows placing an offender on post-prison supervision on inactive status, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Mark, you hear from DOJ? DOC, excuse me.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Mark Cadott. I'm the Community Corrections Chief for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And as committee counsel stated, Senate Bill 75 seeks to eliminate the sunset clause from House Bill 3508, Section 23. And what Section 23 does is allows local control offenders, or those offenders sentenced to 12 months or less, to move to an inactive status. So that aligns with the board practice right now. So those offenders sentenced to more than 12 months and go to DOC custody, come out on post-prison supervision, there's a mechanism for them to move to inactive status. This would allow the practice to continue for local control offenders, or those offenders sentenced to 12 months or less, to have that same privilege. They can earn their way to inactive status while on local control post-prison supervision. So once they're on inactive supervision, they're still subject to arrest. They can be returned to inactive supervision should the circumstances merit. So basically this aligns the practice with board cases for local control offenders. There's no negative fiscal impact. In fact, there's a small savings for community corrections funding, and the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors is in support of this bill as well.
Any members? Any comments, questions? Can you, about the middle of the handout, you're talking about 228 days of supervision saved with 228, and that represented a cost saving of $783,000. How do you get those numbers?
Co-Chair Krieger, the 228 days is the average number of days that the period of post-prison supervision for this 338 offenders. So we've moved 338 offenders off active supervision to inactive, and each of those saved an average of 228 days. And then we use the capitated rate that it costs to supervise a person on post-prison supervision and use that to multiply for the cost savings.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the procedure currently for moving a post-prison supervision client to inactive status? What's the current procedure?
Representative Hicks, the current procedure is that the case moves automatically to inactive status unless the supervising officer takes the step to continue active supervision. So if there's circumstances that merit continued active supervision, for example, payment of restitution is a big one. They're not allowed to go to inactive status if they owe restitution. So the supervising officer would submit a report to the parole board or to the local supervisory authority requesting that the case be continued on active status.
What was the procedure prior to the passage of House Bill 3508?
For board cases, that was the same procedure because that didn't impact 3508. But there was no process for local control offenders prior to 3508. They served out the full term of their post-prison supervision on active status. So until 3508 came into being, there was no mechanism to move local control offenders onto this inactive status.
Okay. Anything further?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kadat, if I correctly remember, one of the reasons for doing this is that the research shows that after a person has been on supervision for a certain period of time, they're less likely to reoffend. Is that correct?
Co-chairs, committee counsel, yes, it is.
Thanks.
Anything further? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 75 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 76.
Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 76A comes to you from the Department of Corrections. Includes within the definition of corrections officer a person employed full-time by the Department of Corrections, the county jail, the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training has certified, and who has supervisory and management responsibilities.
Have Michael Grauer and Marilyn Lawrence come up, please. Grauer.
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Nora's giving each other a bad time about what division they work in.
Mr. Taylor can help translate, I'm sure. Co-Chair Krieger and Co-Chair Barker and House Committee members, my name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Department of Corrections. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 76. What we're doing here is we're asking for the expansion of the definition of a corrections officer under ORS 181-610. Right now, our staff go to the academy where they get actually certified through BCC, get the certification, and as when they get promoted up through the ranks, because of the way the definition is right now, once you stop having primarily perform the duties of custody or direct control supervision of the inmates, your certification goes by the wayside. So what happens is once our staff promote up to about assistant superintendent, superintendent, to my level, assistant director, or even the deputy director level, because of the definition, you lose your certification, you're unable to keep it. So what we're asking for is the expansion to include, and we collaborated with DPSST on the language, so that now incorporated would be the supervisory and management authority to include for corrections officers. That way our staff that worked hard for the certification would not lose their certification just because they promoted. Now, not everyone that promoted up the rank that had the certification, as long as you have in the line of the chain of command, the supervision of the inmate should be able to maintain that certification. We anticipate about 30 people in our organization, Department of Corrections, that this would include, that would be taken care of, and also our county partners. To my knowledge, we have no opposition to the bill. We spoke with both of our labor unions. Asked me and the association. Again, we collaborated with DPSST, and there is no fiscal impact to this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Co-Chair Krieger. Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The bill has been accurately summarized, and my only reason for being here is simply to confirm that this was a very collaborative effort. When the Department of Corrections brought the concern to us, it was our pleasure to work with them. I believe that this is an issue that may affect local corrections agencies that are large enough to have several supervisory layers, as well as the Department of Corrections. This concept was reviewed by the Corrections Policy Committee and the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training, and both of those bodies enthusiastically supported the concept. They believed that it was fair in a corrections agency for supervisors and managers to retain their certifications just as police officers do when they advance professionally in their careers. As Mr. Gower said, there's no fiscal impact. Our agency has none, expects no implementation impacts. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Committee members, have any questions? I'll let you off easy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 76 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 423. Clint Peters, Max Williams, and Martin, is it Petoni?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 423 comes to you from the Judiciary Committee on behalf of the Department of Corrections. Allows the Department of Corrections and the Youth Authority to certify pursuant to rule employees to provide mental health services to inmates.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we appreciate you hearing Senate Bill 423. I think we've talked to almost all of you individually about this bill. It addresses a problem essentially that was created last legislative session by Senate Bill 177, which was a bill that changed standards with respect to the delivery of mental health services. What we're asking for today in this bill, on behalf of myself and the Oregon Youth Authority and Ms.
Mr.
Peters,
Williams?
Can I? Yes, I'm sorry.
I gave your name.
Oh, I apologize.
I'm not certain who you are.
Yes, I. Of all people, I apologize. For the record, members, chairs and members of the committee, Max Williams, Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. Senate Bill 423 will restore both DOC and OYA's ability to provide constitutionally mandated health care services by bringing our mental health specialists within the existing exemption from Senate Bill 177's Licensing and Practice Act requirements for persons that have mental health certifications or licensure from another public agency. Essentially, we'll be conforming the licensure requirements of the Department of Corrections and the Youth Authority, the similar licensure requirements of the Department of Human Services at the State Hospital. This is critical for us primarily because we have about 48 at the Department of Corrections, about 48 people who provide these services. Without this amendment, only 13 of them would actually meet the necessary new licensure requirements, requiring us to either go through a process of laying these people off and then rehiring people who meet the current current licensure requirements. The standards that they currently meet are the same licensure requirements that are required for people who provide these services in the community. We've worked with the various stakeholders involved in this, and you'll hear testimony from the licensing board here in a moment with respect to the bill, but we're not aware of there being any opposition at this time to the bill. So with that, I'll conclude my comments, and Ms. Peters can make hers.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Colette Peters. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority and happy to be here today. I won't re-summarize the bill, as Director Williams has done a great job, but I do want to highlight that the issue is also critical for OIA because of the 33 staff that we have employed as qualified mental health professionals, 17 are licensed. So as Director Williams pointed out, with the remaining 16 QMHPs, they would not be able to continue in their positions at the agency, where we believe they provide critical mental health services to our young offenders. Some of the agency's small facilities in rural areas do not have a licensed QMHP, which would create an unworkable situation where we potentially could not provide mental health services at that agency. I would also like to highlight that staff who are hired as qualified mental health professionals must have academic credentials in specific areas and demonstrate competence in assessment, diagnosis, and treatment. In addition to those qualifications, our QMHPs are assessed clinically by supervisors during their probationary period to ensure they meet the requirements of the agency. I would just like to note on the record that I fully support young offenders in OIA being provided with professional mental health services by individuals trained to do that job. I am confident that the QMHPs we currently have across the state working in our facilities provide professional mental health services. I appreciate your support in supporting Senate Bill 423 and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any members?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Max Collette. I get where you're wanting to go and kind of shift the gears a little bit here to be able to provide that the help there for the mental health side. I don't understand why you had 11 no's on the Senate floor. What is there some opposition there that they were struggling with? I don't understand.
Co-chairs and Representative Olson, sometimes you draw the short straw and committee council schedules you as the very first bill of a legislative session in front of a committee who's meeting for the very first time. And I honestly think that we sort of got caught up at some level in that process. There was a lot of conversation about this bill because it was really the first bill out of the hopper to talk about. And maybe some confusion about, or at least some opposition to the notion that agencies, as the conversation sort of developed and as I tracked it, it was more about the ability of, should agencies be able to establish any of their own standards by rule? And so it became more about agency rulemaking as opposed to specifically related to the content of this specific bill. So that sort of got mixed up, I think, in the detail. The bill came out of the Senate, as I recall, and I don't have the vote sheet in front of me, but I think it came out of the Senate committee with only one no vote, but then picked up some additional no votes on the floor in the debate. That I think was more about agency rulemaking authority than about the specific nature of this bill. I think there was initially a concern that somehow we were creating a duplicate set of standards because we were allowing the licensure to occur inside state agencies differently than the licensure on the outside of state agencies. All that the Department of Corrections and the Youth Authority were trying to accomplish with this bill was simply to put ourselves in compliance with the same standards that Oregon State Hospital gets to use for the purposes of its mental health specialists providing these same sets of services, and to address a real serious concern about our ability to deliver constitutionally mandated mental health care services when it would, by an action independent of us, essentially create non-licensed professionals who, without this change, would no longer be able to practice in our environment. The burden of both laying off existing staff who we believe are ably providing these services and then going out and having to rehire people to come in to fill those services, we felt created a significant enough burden, and I believe the agency who's responsible for licensure ultimately agreed with that as well, that the purpose was to allow us to come in under the same exemption to provide these institutional-based services. So I think in the mix of that conversation, a lot not having to do particularly with either of the departments, but more generally with the legislature's concern about agency's rulemaking authority, I would have to say that's how I think things got sort of sidetracked in the conversation is occasionally they happen, from my own experience on the floor. The thing that is the thing in the bill sometimes doesn't become the thing that gets talked about on the floor, that sometimes doesn't necessarily become the reason people choose to vote against something. That's my assessment. Obviously, each individual member had a reason for why they chose to vote no on the Senate floor, and you'd have to directly inquire of them on an individual basis to know for sure.
A little bit longer answer than what I wanted, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Co-chair Creel, co-chair Parker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Petioni. I'm the executive director for the Board of Licensed Social Workers, and I'm simply here to put on the record the support of the board for this bill. The board was the author of the original Senate Bill 177 that passed in 2009, 60-0 in the House, 24-4 in the Senate. There was lots of help given to us by various committees, including Representative Tomei's committee on the House side, and I simply want to state for the record that the reason the board supports this bill is because it is fully consistent with Senate Bill 177 as was passed. 177, the reason it passed so overwhelmingly, it was a compromise bill that significantly expanded the regulatory authority of the board. Part of that compromise was around what the standards and what the exemptions are from licensure with respect to the public sector, and there never was an intent to not do something for DOC and OYA that wasn't already in place for DHS. So this basically is a cleanup bill from the board's perspective. It does not subtract from the original bill as passed, and it does not add anything to the original bill as passed. And I just wanted to state that for the record, and then I'm happy to answer any questions about any relationship between this bill and the original bill as it passed.
The 35 employees that says they have the same training and education, what would they have to do to meet the licensure thing? What would of the original of the 13?
Chairs, Representative Krieger, I think it the difference at some level, I believe, is an educational requirement. I think typically most of the people that we have are fulfilling this requirement have bachelor-level degrees and then various levels of specialty training in the mental health area. I think the requirements to qualify under the 13, I think that group has a higher educational credential as part of their overall credentials. That's about the extent of the detail that I can speak to. I'm sure that Mark could probably answer those questions more carefully than me.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, it actually gets complicated at that point. First of all, if you limit the answer just to a comparison to the Board of Licensed Social Workers type licensure standards, the simple answer is for licensure at the clinical level with the board that I represent requires a master's degree, and then at initially supervised practice under supervision after you come out of school for 2 years before you're eligible for an independent license. However, I think it's important that in the interests of full disclosure, when you're talking about the larger topic of compliance with 177, licensure with this board is not the only option to comply with the bill. You have other options. You can, you know, if licensure is the issue, licensure through the Board of Psychologist Examiners, licensure through the Board of Licensed Counselors and Therapists, all of those are additional options that staff have. And of course, I'm not really permitted to speak on the specific, about those specific boards, but I just want to put it on the record that there are multiple options for compliance with the bill, including licensure through those other boards.
Okay, committee, any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 423. I think we're done for the day. Mm-hmm. And we don't have anything before us, so we'll be finished till tomorrow. Thank you.